hello and welcome back to the True Blue LA podcast. Eric, we give you a week off.
Yay!
That's nice. That's nice. It's nice of us. I say us as if it's not just you yourself saying I'm taking the week off.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm out of here. And then you heard tires squealing as soon as we stopped recording.
So we have two weeks to catch up on. There's a lot of news, a lot of just like little tidbits to catch up on. Nothing huge other than the fact that, oh, they're in this really fascinating division race. So we'll touch on that, but that's been the same thing for about the last 3 years. We'll touch on all the little news bits. We'll do the regular stuff we do at the end. Dodgers Rewind, questions from Craig. All that after this.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Correct me if I'm wrong, because I was, you know, two when this happened. Don Drysdale was, like, doing radio when Oral broke the streak, right?
Oh, yeah. And TV.
Oral going to be doing TV when Max Scherzer breaks the streak?
Well, so the thing, the only thing about Max Scherzer's streak is it's not a scoreless streak. Because he had one unearned run three starts ago.
Oh.
But he has gone five straight starts with no earned runs. So that's something.
Is there a longer unearned run streak, I wonder?
There, you know what? I think there is. I think John Wiseman tweeted it. I'll look it up and add to the show notes. I think there was someone, I think, who had like a streak in the 70s. Not the 1970s, like 70 something innings. With no unearned runs. With no earned runs, excuse me. But Oral was like second on that list. So like it's not there hasn't been like a bunch of people going, if only
Oral
I had
doing
given
it
up that
next year.
That's right.
When it happens. When they
yeah, Scherzer's streak will extend into next year and then,
that'll be good.
When he resigns with the Dodgers. And the thing is, like, Scherzer's not really, like, I mean, he's mentioned, obviously, in here, but he's not really he's not, like, the main thrust of this podcast. I mean, you've seen, everyone who's listening, they see the title. It's not, like, last week was all about Scherzer. I think a couple weeks ago was a lot about Scherzer. So, not that we're suffering Scherzer overkill. He's been ridiculous. Like, his ERA with the Dodgers is 0.78, but there's a lot more stuff to talk about. Plus, we're catching up on 2 weeks. The Dodgers were 10-3 in the last 2 weeks, and they're still a game back of the Giants, which is what they were 2 weeks ago. But it's been a little more volatile. Like they got it, or the Giants increased that up to 2.5 games, and then the Dodgers sort of crept back. Now they're a game back, 12 to play. So that's where we're at. The Dodgers did clinch a playoff spot last week. They're ninth straight. So obviously they want to win the division, but just knowing they're in the playoffs is one thing. And like we sort of knew that was going to happen, but it became official last week. They clinched one day after the Giants did. So yeah, that's where it's at. One other thing that's sort of not, there's just a cool little thing. Mookie Betts on Sunday in Cincinnati. TJ Friedl, I believe it was his second major league game. He played on Sunday, hit a home run, and then it was his first major league hit. And Mookie Betts in right field, it was hit to right field. He was like yelling up to the fan, the Reds fan, who caught the ball and like told him the situation, like, "Hey, it's his first major league hit. Like, give us the ball or whatever." And he's like, "I got you," I think is what he told the fan. And then so Betts retrieved the ball like immediately, which is always great. And then so you know TJ Friedl has his first home run ball. The beginning of the next inning, Mookie Betts brought one of his own bats signed for the guy. Now that's a good trade off. Like if you're just a guy, even if you're a Reds fan, you know, getting a signed bat from Mookie Betts, that's pretty cool. I think C. Trent Rosecrans in The Athletic did a story on him. It was a guy in Cincinnati for a bachelor party. just, "Hey, let's go to the Reds game." And then, like, hey, next thing you know, he has a signed bat for Mookie Betts. But I thought a cool thing, right when he got the bat, like, there were a Dodger fan and his son. And the son's, like, a huge Mookie Betts fan. And the guy, like, immediately, like, let the kid, like, pose with the bat. And, like, that was kind of cool. It would have... Obviously, the story would have been amazing if the guy just said, "Here, have the bat, kid." Like, it just would have been awesome. But it was just cool. Like, the fact that, like, if I don't play video games that much anymore, and but like if you set an awareness level for players, like Mookie Betts would have the highest, right? Like, he 99 is usually the max. He'd be at like 107. Roughly, he just always seems to know what's going on. Like, how do you like know that? You know, like obviously, this is a new guy. We just saw him yesterday, but like, oh shit, that's his first hit. Like,
yeah, he mentioned that he saw on the scoreboard or whatever behind him when he came up to bat Friday or Saturday. I forget which, if it was Friday or Saturday.
I think it was Saturday, but yeah. Yeah.
That it was his first major league appearance, so he just snuck. Yeah, Bob Guerin-esque awareness.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, Bob Guerin. If coaches should be in video games, you should be able to select a coach. But no, yeah, his awareness would be off the charts. But yeah, just incredible. That was really awesome. I thought it was cool. Another thing that's cool. Wow, Segways. Yeah, two weeks off or a week off, and we're just still humming. Blake Kershaw now pitching again for the Dodgers. It's been a while, to quote Stained. So he last pitched July 3rd and then came back last week, over 2 months old, or over 2 months on the injured list, excuse me, elbow soreness.
He is, in fact, over 2 months old.
that's right. Yeah, exactly. He missed 58 games. It's one of those things. I think it's officially like forearm soreness, but it's really elbow soreness. It's all like related. So like, there's no real reason to get caught up. He's mentioned elbow multiple times. Like, it's very clear what it was. He was back last Monday. So he had a 3-inning rehab start. And then basically what the Dodgers were doing for like 2 months straight was like either with David Price or like shoulder addled Tony Gonsolin for a while, or rookies Josiah Gray before he was traded, and then Andre Jackson or Mitch White. They had essentially had like a 4-inning guy as a bulk guy, and they were just doing a bunch of bullpen games. So I thought like, well, we could have Clayton Kershaw do another rehab game, or we could just have him be our 4-inning guy like his first time out. And so he did 4 1/3. He was pretty efficient. So they sent him back out for like one batter. I think he said after the game, because I think he got the pitcher, and he got him out on one pitch, and then they immediately took him out. But I think that was planned. And he said, like, the up and down is what's harder for me. Like, just like, you know, sitting and then going back out to pitch. Like, that's a thing more than, like, necessarily a pitch count. So he was good 4 1/3 in that game. And then 5 innings on Sunday against the Reds. He looked really good on Sunday. Like, the slider especially was working. The curveball was great. Like, they were just moving like crazy. He got 15 swings and misses on the slider alone and 20 swings and misses just in those 5 innings. And, like, so he struck out 8. He had 13 strikeouts, and he only allowed 2 runs in the 2 starts combined. So now it's just a matter of, like, you know, is he, like, obviously they'd like to be able to set their rotation how they want, and if it's how they want is it going to be – is he going to be the number 3 guy or the number 4 guy? Like, I have a hard time envisioning a scenario where, like, they relegate Kershaw to being the 4th guy. But, I mean, just the fact that he hasn't pitched in well, like, and that Julio Urias has done so well, it's certainly possible.
And if they get a game 163 or a wild card, it's going to be messed up for a bit anyways. So
yeah, it's scramble. It's a little bit of a scramble. So they'll figure it out. But yeah, he has 2 more starts. It looks like they're both going to be on 5 days rest. He's going to go this coming Saturday and then probably the last Friday of the regular season. So he'll be, you know, built up about as much as he was going to be heading into October. So that's a good sign. The other sort of returnee is more surprising in that it wasn't. I don't think it was expected. Maybe expected that he might have come back, but, like, not that he's contributing at this level. Like, so Gavin Lux, this was when I was on vacation. I went out to Palm Springs for a few days. They called up both Matt Beatty and Gavin Lux, who were both optioned at the end of August in. It was right after that 16-inning game, and, like, the time they were still churning through relievers, and it really was a roster crunch at the time. Dave Roberts literally said roster crunch, and he was right. But, you know, it was one of those things, like, I thought with Beatty, because he had a very specific role, like, pinch hitter, trusted pinch hitter, like, they went to him a lot. I thought they'd bring him back once his 10 days were up. They didn't. It took a little longer. And then Lux, it was like he wasn't really doing well. They traded for Trey Turner. He didn't have an infield spot. So they had him play outfield a little bit in Triple A, but he only played 2 games there in the outfield. He played some other games in the infield, but they brought him back when Billy McKinney went down, but it happened within, the same day. And then also AJ Pollock still hurt. So, like, they called up Lux, and they've had him start every single day in left field. The only time he didn't start was when on Friday in Cincinnati, he got hit by a pitch from a pitching machine on his forearm, and he was out. And then Dave Roberts said, you know, he's probably not going to start Saturday and Sunday. He might be available off the bench. Then he started Saturday, hit a 2-run triple, and he started Sunday and hit a 2-run homer. So, and the 2-run homer was off a lefty, like, and he wasn't hitting lefties at all, like, this year. So, like, you know, the only thing, he obviously, new to the outfield, the communication leaves a little bit to be desired. I think in one of his first games, he ran into Cody Bellinger on a play to left center. Didn't think much of it at the time. They were kind of having fun with it in the dugout a little bit. But, like, you know, I think his glove hit Bellinger in the face. But they, like, collided just a little bit. It turns out, less than a week later, we find out that Bellinger suffered a non-displaced fracture in his ribs because his season couldn't get any more cursed. and, like, he played through it a little bit and then, like, ended up not playing Saturday or Sunday at all in Cincinnati, and who knows what's going to happen there. But, yeah, so just brutal, brutal luck for Cody Bellinger this year. However, that said, Gavin Lux, the main thing, like, he's been hitting. Like, so he is, let's see, Lux is 11 for 24 since getting called up and just doing just about everything. Dodgers, I was looking this up before I think Lux came back, or maybe it was last week or something. This is through yesterday. Dodgers number 8 hitters all year, hitting 195 with a 284 on base and 319 slugging, 64 WRC plus. That ranks 27th out of 30 teams in Major League Baseball. That's very bad. Like, they're above average in every other lineup position. Now, Austin Barnes has the most plate appearances, batting 8th, 154. Lux has 97. But it's been like a real collection of everyone, like Zach McKinstry, who hasn't really hit, Cody Bellinger, Billy McKinney, a little bit of AJ Pollock, and then like all the extra guys like Luke Rayleigh, DJ Peters, Sheldon Noisy, a bunch of and Yoshi Tsutsugo before he went to Pittsburgh and started hitting, Edwin Rios, who was hurt a lot. So really not getting anything from the 8th spot. Now, Lux has either batted 7th or 8th in every game. Batting 8th since returning, he's 9 for 15 with a homer, triple, and a double. So, like, he's single-handedly bringing up the number 8 spot numbers for the Dodgers. Now, A.J. Pollock's coming back this week. Chris Taylor missed, like, 5 games with like, neck soreness. So that helped a little bit in terms of getting Lux playing time. We'll see what's going to happen when Pollock gets back. I don't necessarily think like Lux is, you know, locked into like the starting lineup. I don't think that's the case at all. But if they could just have him as an option, like, you know, maybe start a postseason game or two or you know, whatever.
And then just he certainly has the option to
be an available guy off the bench. Yeah, exactly. You're right. Yeah, sorry.
Play, you know, you play like this the rest of the season, you may work your well in, like, how can we leave him off? So,
yeah, I mean, he's certainly on the roster. It's just a matter of, like, how is he? He could be not that they would go strict platoon, because it's not fair to, like, Chris Taylor, and you certainly don't want to play Cody Bellinger against all righties, but like, they could go, you know, not a straight platoon, but like there's a lot of right-handers they're going to face. So you can mix Lux in there however you want. And then, you know, Pollock and Taylor as needed. And then we've talked about this before, like Bellinger shouldn't play, like he shouldn't start, but like he's probably going to play some. But I think just the fact that Lux is an option and a viable one, at the very least off the bench and an occasional starter, perhaps, like, is adds a new dimension, I think, to the, we talked all the time about the depth. It's been tested this year, but having him as another option really does make them deep. So like that's a good thing, I think.
Especially when Pollock comes back.
Yeah. And that's supposed to happen. He is in Camelback Ranch this week, and then they're playing in Phoenix against the Diamondbacks starting Friday. He's supposed to get activated during that series. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, you got a thing for me?
Oh yeah. So we're not going to do like postseason roster yet, although I would imagine that's probably coming next week. I just think I just wanted to point out the way the bullpen has been used recently. We have a very, very good idea who the playoff relievers are, and like we kind of knew that anyway, but just it's really played itself out recently. Like they're currently carrying 16 pitchers on the roster, 11 relievers and 5 starters, and the one thing that's helped is that it's 5 actual starters. Like Tony Gonsolin's shoulder is feeling good, Clayton Kershaw's back, so they actually have like pitchers going through, you know, at least 5 innings pretty much every time out, or at least expected to. And they're not having to do bullpen games, so it's not really testing the depth part. So we're sitting here on recording on September 21st. Evan Phillips hasn't pitched in the last 11 games. Shane Green hasn't pitched in the last 10 games. Bruzdar Gratterall has pitched once in the last 10 games. David Price, who has a sore elbow, has pitched once in the last 13 games. So already that's four of the 11 active relievers. So we're really down to seven, and one of them is Justin Brühl, who's the second left-hander. He's pitched four times in 17 games in September. Once was in a bullpen game in San Francisco on September 3rd, and then his last three appearances came down five, up eight, and up five. So he's like low leverage city. So it's really just six guys. Is their bullpen? Is there like the trusted circle? I guess you would say. Kenley Jansen, Blake Treinen, obviously are the upper tier of that, and then some combo of Corey Knebel, Joe Kelly, Phil Bickford, and Alex Vesia. And then I think come the playoffs, it's just a matter of like who's the second lefty going to be. I mean, is David Price's elbow healthy enough to be on the roster? Justin Brühl, like, has he really shown enough? Do they bring Victor Gonzalez back? He's been in AAA. Just given his experience from last year. So I think that's just a choice they're going to make. But that'll play out over the last 2 weeks. But that's sort of where we're at right now with the bullpen.
That said, having those six dudes feels still a little weird to have Joe Kelly included in that list. But,
right.
You know, he's shown it. Joseph has shown up.
Yeah, he has been as stable as a Joe Kelly can be, I think. Okay, so I do have a trivia question for you. Not bullpen related, but it's Dodgers related. Like,
all right.
It's always Dodgers related. We tend to – it's weird how this season's framed, because it's really – what it really is one of the best seasons the Dodgers have ever had. And we're looking at it like – or a lot of people are looking at it like, why can't the Dodgers catch the Giants? When it in reality it's just like two teams playing excellently. Now that said, in their last 40 games, the Dodgers are 31-9. Does that track to you? Because that it kind of shocked me. Like I knew they've been playing well, but like that number just kind of shocked me a little bit.
It does. There was a streak where they like had like lost one or two in a really long span, yeah. And I remember thinking, you know what, that actually does kind of track just because of how often I would watch and they would win. I would watch and they'd win, and how uniquely frustrating a loss would end up being.
So it got me to thinking. So the 2013 team famously had the 42-8 run in 60 games. They were also, we thought, oh wow, that's a once in a lifetime thing. And 4 years later, they went 43-7 in a 50-game stretch. That team also went 52-9 in a 61-game stretch, which was insane. So it got me thinking. So the Dodgers are 31-9 in their last 40. There's 12 games left. So that's the last 52 games. I think they won the first three of those 40 games. So they are 29-9 in their last 38. So if you want to look at their last 12 games, which will give us a record over the final 50 games. What's the most wins the Dodgers team had in the final 50 games of the season?
I will take a stab at that after this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com.
That's BlueNile.com.
What is the Dodgers' record for the best finish last 50 games to end a season? That's what that's what you need?
Yep.
Well, this is going to be a guess. Let's go with 38-12.
Okay, so you're very close. Before I give you the answer, I'll just tell you the answer is 37. I won't. I'll tell you the teams in a second. So last year was only a 60-game season, so it doesn't. It's not quite the same to say like last 50 games, but they were 36-14 over the last 50 games. They are the way Baseball Reference looks at it now. They're 36-14 over their last 50 games this year, although it's not their last 50 games yet because they're still going to play 12. Two Brooklyn teams were 37-13 to finish. 1924, a team that was like surprisingly in contention, they ended up finishing in second. They were 37-13 over the last 50. And then the 1953 team, which is they didn't win the World Series, but they're kind of the gold standard in terms of like performance, like wins, offense, just run differential, like almost every like Brooklyn record or Dodger record is like to that team. They were 105-49, just a ridiculous year. But they had 37-13 to finish the year. So those are the two records. So if the Dodgers go, all they have to do is go 9-3 to beat that. So they're in decent shape.
It's good. You know what else is good?
What?
The Dodgers Rewind I'm about to listen to.
Yep. So this was someone I didn't really know about, which is always a good sign when doing a Dodgers Rewind because it makes it more interesting. It's fun to learn about new players, or I guess old players. So Max Scherzer, we talked about his five straight starts with zero earned runs. He's one off the franchise record. The aforementioned scoreless streaks of Oral Hershiser and Don Drysdale, they had six straight games with zero runs allowed. So I believe, man, I have to look this up. I think Drysdale's was six straight shutouts. I know Hershiser had the 10-inning scoreless game that wasn't it went longer, so it wasn't. Yeah, Drysdale was six straight shutouts, so the offense scored for him. Hershiser had the five shutouts and then the 10-inning game, which was remarkable. And then the other one was Zach Greinke in 2015. He had a 45 2/3 inning scoreless streak. The reason it was 2/3 because one of his starts was cut short in the middle of an inning, and nothing happened in that inning. So he does get the 2/3. It's a weird thing how sometimes the fraction of an inning counts and sometimes it doesn't. But yeah, anyway, that's where we're at. So those are the six straight guys. I was looking down the list below Scherzer's five, and it, Clayton Kershaw has a few four-streak starts. Fernando Valenzuela, Don Sutton. Alex Wood in 2017 did one. But then one stood out. Freddie Fitzsimmons in 1941 with the Dodgers. He had a four-start streak of zero earned runs. I looked. He actually allowed nine unearned runs in that stretch. Three of the games he allowed runs, but they were all unearned. So that must have been weird, that little stretch. But he still pitched very well during that stretch. He was also, I think, 38. I looked it up. He had seven scoreless innings in Game 3 of the 1941 World Series. The game was scoreless after seven. In the seventh, he took a line drive off his left kneecap from the opposing pitcher, Marius Russo, who another player I had never heard of, started for the Yankees in that game. He had to leave the game. The Yankees scored twice in the eighth off Dodgers relievers and to break a scoreless tie. They won the game 2-1. They led 2-1 in the series, and then they ended up winning in five games. So it's literally a tough break. I don't know if he actually broke his kneecap, but I think I was reading accounts of it, and he collapsed on the field. He still finished the inning, which is amazing. This is one of the better leads to a Sabre bio I've ever seen. Gregory Wolfe wrote this about Freddie Fitzsimmons. With his short arms and legs, long torso, and ample midsection, right-hander fat Freddie Fitzsimmons may not have looked like a major league pitcher during his 19-year career with the New York Giants and Brooklyn Dodgers from 1925 to 1943, but with one of baseball's most effective knuckleballs and a deceptive whirling delivery, he won 217 games. Now that is an opener. That's how you open an article, folks. Pretty amazing. So I, you know, with the nickname Fat Freddy, you want to see like how big he was. Baseball Reference lists him as 185. His Sabre bio mentions, I think he was 175 when he started in the majors. It says he got 215 and up. So I don't know how far and up goes, because that's doing a lot of work here. He threw a knuckleball, like not all the time, but enough of the time to like keep people honest. I was reading too, like he had exceptional control of the knuckleball as much as you can. Like he threw it for strikes, which is rare, but also like people didn't know when it was coming because he mixed in enough of his other pitches. This is from Leo DeRocher in his book, Nice Guys Finish Last. If you ever saw Freddie pitch, you can never forget him. He would turn his back completely to the batter, and as he was winding up, wheel back around and let out the most god-awful grunt as he was letting the ball go, like a rhinoceros in heat.
What was that?
amazing. I haven't seen audio of Freddie Fitzsimmons winding up. I'm efforting to find it. Imagine like Zach Greinke or Rich Hill like level of volume when on the mound. So he only pitched for the Giants and Dodgers in his career. The Dodgers acquired him when he was 35 in 1937 for a pitcher named Tom Baker, who didn't pitch too much more after that trade. Fitzsimmons pitched in parts of seven seasons for Brooklyn. He had a 3.41 ERA, a 1.16 ERA plus. I was looking up, he didn't pitch much. Like he was described as a once a week pitcher. In 1940, he was 16-2 with a 2.81 ERA. He did that in only 20 games and 18 starts. Like, he really was, like, just used occasionally. He ended up finishing fifth in the MVP that year. What I loved about this, he pitched 709 and a third innings with the Dodgers. He had 176 walks and 177 strikeouts. It was a different time. He pitched 19 years, total 217 wins, 112 ERA plus. He had just under 36 Baseball Reference WAR in his career. He later managed the Phillies 1943-45. Then he coached for something like 20 years. He was on Leo DeRocher's staff with the 1951 Giants. DeRocher managed him with the Dodgers. He was essentially like the pitching coach, although they didn't really – I don't think they – at that time, I don't think they differentiated like coaching titles. It was just like, here, you're on the staff, but he was pitching coach basically. This was interesting in 1943 and 44, so like right after his playing career ended, and while he was managing the Phillies, he was the GM of the football Brooklyn Dodgers of the All-America Football Conference, which is like amazing. Like we talk about Bo Jackson and Deion Sanders, but like. That's an amazing double duty for baseball football. So I found this little note about Fitzsimmons when he was a manager. This was from a Jim Murray column, I believe. Oh no, it was not a Jim Murray column, but this was from a column in 1976 recalling an incident when he was a Class A manager in the Yankees system in 1956. He seemed like a hard ass. In spring training at Orangeburg, South Carolina, where despite his 54 years, he frequently pitched a healthy batting practice, he came, he gave firm evidence of his respect for, quote-unquote, the way it was in baseball tradition. A first-base candidate for the triplet team, who'd hit a grand slam home run in an inter-squad game that day, treated his wife and young daughter to steaks in the restaurant where the team ate. Married players, not encouraged to bring their families, were allowed the same per diem meal money as a single player, which wasn't enough to underwrite one T-bone, say nothing of three. But the big hero paid no cash, signing the check as was permitted up to the limit for the club to pay, signing it not Al Weigant, but Lou Gehrig. Fitzsimmons almost exploded when he was told. The fraudulent Gehrig was shortly shipped outside the New York Yankees system, proceeding to hit 49 home runs that summer, not one of which changed Fitzsimmons' opinion of him one whit. So, first of all, that's a ballsy move. Like, but also, what a bunch of cheap asses. Like, sorry, you're. I mean, I get it though. Like, you can't really defend you, but yeah, what a hard ass. Anyway, Freddie Fitzsimmons retired out here. He lived in Yucca Valley for years, which is close to where I grew up in Palm Springs. He died in 1979. So, yeah, that was him. I have a Fitzsimmons trivia question for you now.
All right.
So, seven scoreless innings, 1941 World Series, are the third most among the Dodgers' 43 pitchers with a career postseason ERA of zero with the team. Can Jacob name either of the two zero ERA postseason pitchers with more than seven Dodgers innings?
Can I get decades on this?
Yeah. One you watched. The other was, one was under Tommy Lasorda.
Okay. I watched give me a decade here.
I'm fairly certain you watched in person.
In person?
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
I could be wrong on that, but it's that era.
Okay. Well, you know, that's a yeah. large swath.
Is it? Yeah.
Man, I need another hint, I think.
The earlier one under Lasorda is a reliever. The other one is a starter, with his entire Dodgers postseason experience is limited, like Freddie Fitzsimmons, to one game.
So Jose Lima?
Yes.
So I was thinking about this question when I actually misread it a little bit, and I thought of Jose Lima. I not only did not watch that in person, I did not watch it on TV.
What?
Very famously, I watched a lot of baseball in the aughts,
yeah.
but I was busy with real life stuff for yeah. the Jose Lima game and 4+1, both of which I had yeah. to like watch afterwards. And so because I did not watch it, I couldn't remember if Jose how many innings Jose Lima went.
The whole way, nine. Yeah. He's the top guy. Terry Forster is the other one, 7 2/3, okay. Which is surprising. So you were what, a freshman in college during the Lima game?
Right? I would have been. Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
Weird. Yeah, I graduated high school early, so I was technically like a second year freshman. That's weird. Uh-huh. But.
Yep. Well, look at you. No. Yeah. The Lima game was interesting. I went with my cousin and a couple friends. And that was when USC was really good at football. It's been a long time. And that was the national championship year that didn't get that, or I guess the second national championship year for counting AP. They were playing Aaron Rodgers' Cal team that day, and they won by six. Cal famously had, first and goal in the fourth quarter, and then Aaron Rodgers threw four straight incompletions, which was like a rarity because I think that game he set a record, like a Pac-12 record for most consecutive completions or something in a game, and they somehow held and they won. And I was, we were listening to that on the way to the game, and I just remember yelling in the car driving to the game, and then good times.
Interesting. I had it in my head as 8 innings, but again, didn't watch it, so very willing to be wrong. But
the final out was, it was a pop out. I want to say it was in foul territory.
I have it
to Adrian Beltre. But yeah, that was nuts because they were down 0-2. So it was like, this stupid team's never going to win. Like, you know, there was that kind of a thing. And then that brought some hope. And then obviously it was crushed by Albert Pujols, among other things, the next night. So yeah. But
you want to take a guess on who caught that game?
Hmm. Oh, so that was after the Laduca trade. So, oh God. So Tom Prince,
Brent Maine.
I was either going to be him or yeah. That was the one of all the crap like Paul DePodesta got for that trade undeservedly. Where he really screwed up was not making sure they had a catcher because they thought they were going to trade for Charles Johnson,
right?
And Charles Johnson vetoed it, and they didn't have another backup plan. So it was like rookie David Ross or Brent Maine and like Tom Prince. And it was like they were terrible down the stretch. So yeah, they needed a backup plan, and they didn't have it. So that was rough.
All right. It's time for
Questions from Craig.
Trivia questions this week are all about the Dodgers versus the Rockies and the Diamondbacks.
I glanced at these and I am gonna bomb like really badly.
Well, we'll keep a healthy pace going then.
Yeah.
And just so you're not fumbling around for just 1 hour of Eric.
Kissing. That's right.
Name the top 10 home run leaders against the Rockies. So I have a list of top 10. Can you name top five?
Okay. So
I'm going to give you...
Don't give me any hints yet.
No. I'm going to give you three strikes.
Oh, gotcha.
Outside the top 10, but I want you to name the top five. That's what I'm aiming for here.
Okay. So Eric Karros and Mike Piazza.
Eric Karros is number one with 36. Mike Piazza is number four of 22. And this is against the Rockies, just to reiterate that. Yeah.
Matt Kemp,
number two of
34. Andre Ethier,
number five of 18.
So I'm missing number three.
Correct.
Oh, Sean Green,
number eight. So still no strikes.
Okay. Gary Sheffield,
strike one.
So he's only 3 years. That was dumb. Three and a half. Okay. Now it's interesting. Rockies. Oh. what was Sean Green's number?
He had 17 home runs and was ranked eighth.
Oh, okay. Adrian Beltre.
Number three with 22. There you go.
You
want to take a stab at the rest of the top 10? You want me to let you know?
Yeah, I will just. I only want to say, just because I think it would be hilarious, but I want to say James Loney.
Number 10 with 15.
He is, yes. Okay, good. Yeah, just give me the rest. Justin Turner.
Nope. Strike two. Max Muncy is six with 18. He's tied with Jock Peterson.
Nice.
And then Chris Taylor is ninth with 16.
Wow, Chris Taylor. Nice. Yeah. Okay.
And then James Loney. All right, same question, same format. I will let you know that there are 12 players on this list because of a tie at the bottom, and this is for the Diamondbacks.
Okay, so Diamondbacks started in 98, so eliminate Piazza at least.
Yep.
This one...
Actually.
That'd be amazing. If like his he was there for a month, like 5 weeks, and he just went off against the Diamondbacks. Okay, so let's just go Kemp and Ethier.
Wow, one and two in that order. Kemp with 29, Ether with 20.
Ooh, okay. Adrian Gonzalez?
Number 6, so no strike, but not in the top 5 with 15. He's tied with 7th place as well.
Okay. Let's go... let's go Justin Turner.
Number 3 with 19. Kind of strange that the Rocky numbers are so much higher. I can't imagine.
Yeah, weird.
A couple of reasons why.
Jock Peterson.
Number 5 with 16, so you're only missing 4th place. Who has 17?
Janice Ian. Let's go Adrian Beltre.
Adrian Beltre tied with Adrian Gonzalez.
With 15. Sean Green.
Number 4 with 17.
Nice.
So you're missing 8 through 12 if you wanted to take any stabs.
Let's go with...
9 through 12 are all tied, by the way. So you're only missing one above that. Who's actually, I should state, is tied with the Adrians.
So Chris Taylor?
Strike 1.
Yasiel Puig?
Strike 2.
I don't know why I'm... Oh, Raul Mondesi.
Strike 3. Oof,
yeah,
you were fire until the end.
I should have said Sheffield, but yeah.
Nope. Cody Bellinger,
yeah.
Yasmani Grandal, JD Drew, Eric Karros, and Manny Ramirez.
I meant to go back and say Karros.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Cool.
All right, so we're going to do the same thing, but on the pitcher's side. Dodgers who have given up the most home runs to the Rockies? And we'll do the same format. That's been working well. So,
This is not fair. Or it's not to him, I mean, not to me. But Clayton Kershaw,
yeah,
just from volume.
Yeah.
Yeah.
27 home runs given up.
Ramon Martinez?
9th place with 12. Tie 7th through 11th are all tied with 12 given up.
Chad Billingsley?
Number 4 with 15 given up.
All right. Let's see. Home runs to the Rockies. Derek Lowe?
No. Keeping that ground ball.
Yeah.
Down.
Yeah. Smart man. Let's go with, Chan Ho Park.
Chan Ho, 10th place. One of the many with 12.
Darren Dreifert?
Strike 1.
Oh, is it? I'm at strike 2, right?
Yeah,
because I said Derek Lowe.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Strike 2. I'll have to go to New York on that.
There's a check swing. It was only 3 years, but let's go before I do that. Kenta Maeda?
Strike 3. So there we go. So we have Hyunjin Ryu.
Yep, he was going to be next.
Third. Hideo Nomo, second.
Oh, nice.
Odalis Perez, 5th.
Of
And then out with one more than the group at 12, you had Walker Buehler, 13.
Mm. Yep.
Then have in the group of 12, along with Chan Ho and Ramon, you have Pedro Estacio, Yimi Garcia.
Wow.
Wow. That's incredible.
And Brad Penny.
That's the Austin Adams by pitch record of Dodger relievers home runs. Yeah.
All right. Same question, but Dodgers against the Diamondbacks.
All right.
We have 3. We have 2 with 8 at the bottom of the list, so it's the list of 11.
Okay. So Kershaw.
Number 1 with 23.
Bueller.
Nope. Strike 1.
Ryu.
Strike 2.
Maeda. Ooh.
Number 4 with 13.
Let's see. Can't really do that. Kevin Brown?
Sorry, there's a name on the list that I find very fascinating. Kevin Brown is number 10 on this list.
Okay. Let's go back to the well with Chad Billingsley.
Bringing that back up. Number two with 14. Tied. There's a tie at 14.
All right. It was only 3 years, but so this is probably not right. But just to get this over with, Zach Greinke.
Sorry. I'm trying to. One of these names is very confusing to me. Zach Greinke is not on this list. I think that's right. Strike three.
Yep.
Kenley with 14. Ooh.
Wow. Yeah.
Kenta Maeda of 13. Chano Park with 12. Rich Hill with 11. Derek Lowe with 10. And that's the number I'm trying to figure out because that was 1 year, I think. And that seems weird.
Wait, who was that last one?
Sorry. Derek Lowe.
No, he was 4 years, right?
But, yeah, no, you're right. Sorry, Brent Fart. Yeah. Odalis Perez with 10. Darren Dreifert with 9. Kevin Brown and Carlos Perez both with 8.
Former Dodger rewind.
Yeah, I put 2008 and 1998 different years. Did you know that?
You know what? Jury's like, still out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense. All right, good job. That was fun.
Nice.
Two-part contest question. So Eric can go first because he's a jerk. And Jared can go first on part P because he's great. The last time the Dodgers played a full 162 season without a player with 30 or more doubles was in 1998. That was Eric Karros finishing with 29 in that season. Mookie Betts has 28 doubles. Will he hit two or more so the 2021 Dodgers will have at least one player with 30?
Not only will Mookie Betts get to 30, he'll get to it during the Rockies series.
How about this? I'll say he will, but it'll be afterwards, just so there's a little bit of contest going on.
Sure.
Yeah, if you had an ad to that, I'm like, there's no way we're making this a contest.
Yeah.
he's looked really good lately.
Yep.
Corey Seager needs one double to reach 20 for the season. This contest question, will not only Seager get at least one more double, can he surpass Justin Turner to move up on this season's double leaderboard? So Justin Turner right now has 21. Corey Seager has 19. I am going first, and I will say he is going to get to 20, but he will not pass Justin Turner because Turner is going to keep hitting some doubles himself.
Okay, so Turner's at 21, Seager's at 19.
Yep.
Jacob says Turner will have more. I say Corey Seager will pass him.
All right, that sounds good.
Or wait, am I saying pass or catch? Surpass. Fine.
And we'll call it a push if they end up with the same number.
Sure. Yep.
I know you're excited for the next question. Do you remember the 21st night of September in celebration of one of my favorite music groups, Earth, Wind & Fire? I wanted to see if you each recall the first time you ever went to a ticket broker office to buy tickets to a concert. What we now call the secondary market. Think about that, Craig has a story on his. First time I did, my friends and I bought floor tickets at the Fabulous Forum for an Earn With Wind and Fire concert. This is when I learned you can be too close when you were looking up to the stage, but a memorable experience was had by all.
So before we were recording this on 21st, and did you already see Demi Adejuyibe's video yet?
I did.
Yeah, beautiful.
Wonderful.
Just a genius. I'm trying to think. I don't think I ever went to a ticket broker office to buy tickets for that. Like, I do remember, like, in the 80s and maybe the early 90s, people had to get, like, Dodger tickets by, like, I mean, you could go to the stadium, but you had to, like, basically go to the ticket counter at like Robinson's May or I guess it was just May Company back then, right? Or you know, Sears or some, like, it was some weird process.
This is what I like. I don't think for a concert I ever did the secondary market ticket broker. I know I had friends get us like good Kings tickets, I think, through that, but not for a concert. But I very frequently went to Robinson's May to get tickets. trying to think of what the first time I would have done that for. Thrice concert, maybe.
Nice.
Bright Eyes concert, maybe. Because my dad had season tickets to the Greek Theater for a while. So that was my formative, nice, you know, concert going experience. Spinal Tap highlight.
Did you at every time after, I guess this would have been after you got your driver's license, but did you ever have to get him to the Greek?
I don't think I ever drove. Maybe I did.
So this will not shock you or anyone. My first concert was Weird Al.
I believe my first concert was Weird Al too, but I don't recall any of the ticket buying process because I would have been eight or something.
It was Magic Mountain. Mine was at the Paris Fairgrounds in Paris, California, not France. Didn't go to France.
Just the idea of the Paris Fairgrounds in France is weird to me.
That's right next to the
Eiffel Tower. Deep fried foie gras. Yeah.
oh, that's amazing. Same thing. I do not remember how I purchased tickets for that. How did we do anything back then? I'm sure there were some things. I remember I was big into especially the NBA had such better videos at the time, but like the season ending videos when the Lakers won a championship or something, I would buy all those. I'd buy the baseball highlight ones, but you basically had to buy those off of an advertisement off TV, and you called a number. And I remember I'd have my mom would pay for it, and it'd be I think the most expensive one was $30. And I just remember I think I paid her $10 out of my allowance for three straight weeks. So that was my payment plan or something. But I don't remember how I was in college when I went to see Weird Al. I want to say I was 19. So I would have bought it myself, but I do not remember how I bought tickets. So yeah, that's interesting.
I have now very vivid memories of the ticket counter.
Yes.
At the Robinson's Bay at the mall. Currently, the 96-54 2021 Dodgers. That's the record. That's a weird, weird range. 2021 Dodgers have the same record at 150 games as the 2017 and 2019 Dodger teams. But while the records are the same, I think that even with all the talent and resources this year's team had, this might be Robert's best year as manager. How do you think he has done this season?
Very well. There's been a lot going on, every team's had injuries, I think, so it's not as simple to just say the Dodgers aren't alone in that, but just sort of navigating through that has helped. He's a pretty steadying force, I think, that helps. You just look at the Padres, right? For all the talk of Roberts does this and that X's and O's wise, the bulk of what a manager does is just not have everyone screw up, or you're basically not have the team implode.
And the Dodgers have had some opportunities to spiral, right? There was the couple of losing streaks early on in the season, dealing with all the injuries, bringing on another shortstop and a team that kind of already had two, a lot of opportunities for things to go wrong. And I think you and I have generally defended Dave Roberts, 2019 game five notwithstanding, as for the same reason you said, is that for the most part, if a manager is doing the bulk of his job really well, you won't really notice it, but you notice it when they're screwing it up.
The Padres the other day, I mentioned it, but it was against the Cardinals. They got swept by the Cardinals. The Cardinals are on fire right now. But Fernando Tatis was nearly got ejected for arguing balls and strikes, and Manny Machado called him out in the dugout. He said, it's not fucking about you, basically. I said shit earlier. It's not all Manny's fault.
All right.
Yeah. And so, that was an amazing dugout confrontation. And the pictures from it are awesome. Amazing pictures. But you,
Like, and there's been some articles written about that where, like,
that's a situation that's gotten out of hand, basically, yes. to get it to that point. Like, a manager, like a good manager would have handled this well before it got to that point.
Right.
Which is like exactly what Dave Roberts says. Like, everyone, like Justin Turner said this, like a lot of people have said this about him, like, he handles stuff, right? Like, part of Roberts' job, and no one likes to hear this, like for all the talk of him being like a puppet for the front office, I mean, in some ways, puppet is a dumb term. Like, but like the fact that a manager and the front office is on the same page, that's required for the job, right? Like, that's part, like, and that's a good thing. Like, having a working relationship with, like, you know, everyone on the same page is good. Like, that's generally what you want, but also part of his job, and sometimes it's not fair, he's the front facing guy who has to lie or just take it. Like, when
and if he does at any point,
you know, like,
disagree with front office, that should be behind the scenes. And you know,
exactly
right. Conclusion.
Yeah, he there's never been a point where Roberts is like, look, man, I can only manage what they give me. You know, like that. He's never done that. I mean, the closest he'll come is like, you know, it's where we're at right now. That's like, but that's like because everyone's hurt or like, or something like that. And then like, and he never rips guys. Like, we talked about this earlier. The closest he came was, and it was very indirect, but it was that one of the Giants games. And he's like, if we stretch there, we win. When it was Sheldon Noisy, like, just stood at second base instead of like stretching a little bit to get the last out. And he didn't even say Sheldon Noisy by name, but it was very clear where Robert stood on that. And that's like the closest Robert has come to like ripping a player, you know, like, so, you know, like he's just, he handles stuff like very well. And like, he's very well respected. So like,
and really after the 2019 Game 5 debacle of X's yes. and O's, there was some nitpicking on what he could and couldn't have done in 2020, but like Pedro Baez, throwing the changeup was a mind, but if you look at the replay, he seems mad at the execution. And it should be noted, the X and O's calling of the clinching game were perfect. Like, every single move was correct.
And as bad as the sending Baez back out was, Roberts like immediately owned that after the game. He's like, look, that's on me. It wasn't like one of those things where he doubled down and was like, I'll do that every time. It was like, yeah, I shouldn't have done it that way. You know what I mean? Like, he knew exactly. So, like, yeah, some of the criticism is well-founded on X's and O's stuff.
Sure.
So a lot of it's not, but, like, he knows what he's doing. And like, I think he's done a very good job. And like, they're lucky to have him, just, you know, given what we've seen, like, around the league. So, like, they're in good hands.
On my trip to Portland last month, I went to a few restaurants to eat the same thing I ordered in 2019. It's got me wondering if there are any times when you go back to a restaurant and order whatever it is you liked the last time you were there. Specifically, he wants to know if you revisited any some old favorites in your recent trip back to Palm Springs.
So the Palm Springs thing was like a mini family reunion. It was a golf trip. We've done this a few times where generally it tends to be in places that are roughly as hot as the sun during like summer, because you can get like really cheap, like relatively cheap accommodations and cheap golf. Like, I don't really golf, but I like hanging out with family and stuff. So like, we had a lot of people out, and we were all like in Palm Desert. There was a lot of golf involved. There was a lot of hanging around. So we didn't like branch out and do like Palm Springs-y stuff. Really, we were just hung out at the pool a lot at the place we were at. The one thing we did do was go to Las Pozuelas, not the one in Palm Springs, but the one in Rancho Mirage, which is, it's Las Pozuelas Nuevas, but it's a bigger restaurant, but it's all under the same family. And that's where we actually had my mom's funeral, lunch afterwards, the funeral. This was 13 years ago. And I think that this was my first time back to that restaurant since then, but yeah, that's been an old favorite. and it was wonderful. That was a lot of fun. I do enjoy like going to old haunts like that. I mix it up. I think when I go there, I can't say I ordered anything like. I did order a giant strawberry margarita, which was wonderful. I can't think of an example of like a go-to thing at a place. Maybe when you answer, I'll try to think of one. But then that was the closest I got to like an old haunt in Palm Springs.
There are some places where just like, what else am I going to order? Like when I go to Philippe, the original, like. Yes. I might change which French dip I get, but I'm going to get French dip. Like, that's just what I'm going
to
get.
Like, you don't go to the Hat and not get pastrami.
Yeah.
Although, you can get a beef dip there.
Yeah.
But I think the solution is you get both.
Both, yeah.
And you eat like a fat pig.
Can still smell the onion rings. I think the one that comes the most to mind to me of both, I've been to this place multiple times and ordered the same thing, and there are other things on the menu that look really, really good, and I just can't do it. It's actually a place in Portland. I think one of the places Craig is mentioning, although he might have actually switched it up this time around. I think maybe he got at Screen Door. I think he might have gotten the waffle and chicken last time, and he switched to what I usually get, which is the... It's funny. It's changed its name a bunch every time I go to it's named slightly differently, but it's biscuits and gravy and chicken is what it is, and that's sometimes it's worded as if it's going to be a sandwich and sometimes it's not, but when even if it's a sandwich, it's a giant piece of chicken, a bunch of gravy, and then two biscuit halves on there, so it's not really a sandwich. Can't eat it without a fork and a knife. You could, but you'd be looked at. So that's the biggest place that comes to mind. Just so many good things that on that menu, and I've seen friends and family order a bunch of different stuff, and it all looks good, but I always have to get the bits of gravy and chicken.
I will say this, what I did order at Las Casuelas, and this is a nice or an occasional go-to if I'm at a sit-down Mexican restaurant, and if I'm not, like, feeling the tortilla, like, I don't want to have, like, necessarily tortillas. I want to do the fork and knife or whatever. Chili Colorado is a good call. That's what I got at Las Casuelas, and it was excellent. That's about as close as I come to like, I try to mix it up a lot, but just go to like a random sit down Mexican restaurant. I'll get Chili Colorado and it'll be fun.
Well, I don't have time to make biscuits and gravy, so I don't know what I'm going to go eat.
Once again, Craig has made my mouth water at the end of an episode, so now I have to figure out what I'm going to do for lunch. You can figure out what you're doing for your next meal after listening to this, but thanks for listening, and we will be back next week just to talk about the playoffs. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye.